Table Mountain Rancheria. Oh, okay.
Your Honors, good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Brian Layton on behalf of the plaintiffs and appellants in this matter. I'd like to reserve approximately half my time for rebuttal. I had 20 minutes prepared, but the court recently had reduced it to 10 minutes, and the court obviously has good reason, so I don't know exactly what the court wishes me to focus on, but...
Well, counsel, if it will help you, I guess since the litigation commenced, our court decided Lewis versus Norton, and it seems to me you've got the laboring oar here to convince us why that case does not control the disposition of this case. That's why we shortened the time of the argument.
I thought that might be one of the reasons. Your Honor, in Lewis versus Norton, it was not a suit against the tribe. It was not a suit against the class plaintiffs who represented the tribe in the 1980 Table Mountain versus Watts action. It was a suit by three people who believed that they should be members of the tribe, who sought to order or request a court to order the Bureau of Indian Affairs to order the tribe to comply with their constitution. The district court, Judge Carlton in that case, was very upset with the tribe but said it had no jurisdiction. It went to a panel of this court, and on that basis, they were also lamenting, they were deeply troubled by that matter, but said that they had no jurisdiction. They said that, quoting the Lewis court, quote, Table Mountains Rancheria's waiver of sovereign immunity in 1983 to obtain federal recognition of the tribe and its membership role at that time did not constitute a waiver of the tribe's sovereign immunity in perpetuity for the resolution of all claims to tribal membership. They also, in ruling that the tribe had not waived sovereign immunity, cited McClendon. But if I can state that in McClendon, it was 10 years before there was an earlier waiver of sovereign immunity by the tribe that dealt with an ownership dispute in land. The Lewis court, describing McClendon, held that the tribe had waived sovereign immunity for purposes of establishing its interest in the land, but did not waive it for purposes of a resolution of later disputes to enforce a lease. That then went on to hold that based upon how Lewis was pled, we were trying to fight over something different than what Table Mountain versus Watt decided. In this case, it is different. This case is not only suing the tribe, it is back before the same court that determined Table Mountain versus Watt. The Lewis case was filed in the Eastern District of California that did not originally hear the Table Mountain versus Watt case.
Let me ask it directly.
Okay.
I read Lewis versus Norton to say that we do not have jurisdiction over the relief that you are requesting, that we order the tribe to admit your plaintiffs as members of the tribe. Why does that case not control this case on that point?
Your Honor, it's spelled out primarily in our reply brief. What we are requesting the court in this case, for purposes of the tribe, not for purposes of the class plaintiffs, that were in the Table Mountain versus Watt case.
Well, without regard to who the parties are, the question is one of the authority of a federal court to tell a sovereign Indian tribe who its members are going to be. And in Lewis versus Norton, our panel pretty clearly said it may result in some unfairness here. There may be some people out there who should be getting their share of the proceeds of the casino operation and the profitable tribal enterprise here. But we don't have the power to order the tribe to admit them to membership so that they can get access to their share of the tribal assets. So that's the question,
right,
isn't it?
Well, what I'm asking the court is That is the comfortable road to take. That's the easy road to take.
It's the controlling road.
But it is not the justiciable rule.
Before you get to that point, do you agree that we do not have subject matter jurisdiction to order the tribe to enroll certain people? Now, I know you have waiver arguments and you have other arguments, but do you agree with that principle, and aren't we bound by that statement in Lewis against Norton?
Under this, if it were the same facts as Lewis versus Norton, yes, I would agree with the court.
You're talking about facts. I'm talking about a proposition of law. Does a federal court have subject matter jurisdiction to order a tribe to enroll people?
Your Honor, this court does under the court's jurisdiction and the district court's jurisdiction in Table Mountain versus Watt. Table Mountain versus Watt and the class plaintiffs sought two things. Restore us as a federally recognized tribe. That happened. And provide to our class plaintiffs the status as Indians. Status as Indians under 25 U.S.C. Section 450 necessarily means membership in a tribe. In the government's complaint, ER 71, paragraph 36 of the Table Mountain versus Watt complaint, it requested declaratory and injunctive relief. The duty owed to the Association of Table Mountain and its constituent members. Status as Indians means recognition of an Indian tribe to begin with, which they got in the 1980 versus Watt action, and membership in an Indian tribe recognized by the federal government. They got both of those in Table Mountain versus Watt. The problem is the class plaintiffs then took it upon themselves to determine who had the status as Indians. Our clients didn't. We are bound by the Table Mountain versus Watt decision, and as the circular, the publication that went out to certify the class and certify the settlement entered into between the government, the tribe, and the named class plaintiffs, who represented us, and the defendants don't dispute it. We were members of that class because we were heirs of distributees, we were dependent members, or we were offspring of dependent members. All of those were to have their Indian status restored under the act, and that action was brought in 1980. In 1975...
If we don't have subject matter jurisdiction, to answer Judge Alarcon's question, then we don't have the authority to order the relief that you're seeking. Even if we accept your argument that they are, how would I put it, pretermitted beneficiaries of the prior litigation, either we have the power or we don't. And if we don't have the power, then we can't afford the relief that you request.
Your Honors, if you ordered the parties, who are now the parties before this court, which were the same parties that were parties in the Table Mountain versus Watt case, to provide my clients the same relief that the plaintiffs, the named plaintiffs, received in that case.
If we don't have the power, it is an order void ad initio. We simply cannot do it.
The problem with your attempt to answer my question, and respectfully, I don't think you did. I asked you to discuss Lewis against Norton, which also discussed the Watt case. Instead, you talked about the Watt case. Would you please answer my question? Doesn't Lewis against Norton make the law of the circuit that we have no subject matter jurisdiction?
Lewis versus Norton was a case against the Bureau of Indian Affairs to order the Bureau of Indian Affairs to recognize my clients as members. The court even lamented in that case we had not sued the tribe in that particular action. So that decision was never determined. It was not a case before the same court where the tribe waived sovereign immunity, went in, and sought relief on behalf of my clients. We never got the relief. Others did. That is why it's different. Lewis versus Norton was not a suit against tribe, and the government said we can't order the government, the agency, to order that the tribe admit us as members. That is a different question than the one that we are posing here, is to order the tribe and the class action plaintiffs to give us the same relief that was given in the resolution in 1983. Now, if they say, okay, we will restore your Indian status, and if that's the best the court can do, we want the same relief. Because right now, the government doesn't even recognize us as Indians. Oh, yeah, when we fill out the census form every 10 years, we put Native American. But we have no ability, we have no rights whatsoever, because we, our status as Indians has not been restored. I claim restoring status as Indians means, pursuant to what Congress said, who wanted the maximum participation, to be recognized as a member of an Indian tribe that's federally recognized. All the court has to do is to order the defendants to comply with the order approving the class settlement pursuant to 23A(e) to provide us the same relief that the named class plaintiffs received with respect to our suit against the named class plaintiffs. From there, they cannot receive a benefit greater than what the who they represent received. They did receive a greater benefit. They breached their fiduciary obligation. They breached their obligations under the class action rules, that they necessarily have to treat us the same as those that are being, that are named as plaintiffs.
Counsel, your time has expired. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Catherine Barton for the United States. I have with me at council table Paula Yost, who is counsel for the non-federal appellees, who's available if there are any questions appropriate for her. It is our position that this case is determined by the decision in Lewis versus Norton. I mean, Lewis, the issue of the Watt settlement was raised in Lewis versus Norton, and its potential impact, you know, any potential deviation from the traditional law, subject matter, jurisdiction, and sovereign immunity waiver. And so the Lewis court actually directly addressed the Watt settlement and held that the tribe had not waived its sovereign immunity in that settlement with respect to future membership disputes, and dismissed the United States on that basis, because the United States doesn't have any power to do anything to order tribal membership. And the same reasoning would apply here with the individual defendants. There's nothing they can do in the absence of the tribe, or even in the presence of the tribe, because the tribe hasn't waived its sovereign immunity. I mean, and there is no subject matter jurisdiction. Just to maybe make clear that even despite this clear law, there's no cause for concern about what the Watts settlement did, I'll make a couple of other points, unless you really want me to sit down. Okay. The Watt case, you know, was brought by the rancheria and the Indians who lived on the rancheria against the federal government. And the only dispute was against the federal government. There wasn't any dispute between the tribe and its members. So there wasn't any membership dispute going on. And the Watt settlement understandably did not address a problem that wasn't raised in the Watt litigation. I mean, that's the reason why the tribe didn't waive its sovereign immunity in Watt. It wasn't sued by its members. It sued us, and there weren't any cross claims against it by its members. So there was no question of membership involved. It was only trying to unwind what had been done by the California Rancheria Act in 1958, which was to take trust status away from the lands, take away and the recognition of the individuals as Indians and the tribe as a federally recognized entity. In fact, the settlement itself states in paragraph 3, the exact language is that the status of the class members as Indians under the laws of the United States is confirmed. But the laws of the United States do not determine tribal membership. I mean, that is the holding of Santa Clara Pueblo versus Martinez and Lewis versus Norton, is there isn't any, it's tribal law that governs membership. So the Watt settlement, by its very terms, only pertain to tribal, any Indian status under the laws of the United States, which cannot be conferred, membership cannot be conferred.
Do you construe that as meaning that the members who are now members of the Indian tribe could get federal benefits?
At the time in the settlement, it meant that they could have land held in trust for them and that they could qualify for benefits that were available to Indians. There are benefits that are available to Indians without having tribal status, or if they were membership status in a tribe, or if they were members of a tribe, would qualify for those benefits. But the membership question always depended on the tribe. The Indian status only goes to the extent that the United States has any power to determine who is an Indian, and that power does not extend to tribal membership. As we've both of our briefs explain also, it just would have been almost unthinkable that the tribe, in bringing an action to have its sovereign immunity reinstated, would have waived the most fundamental aspect of sovereign immunity, which is that it can determine who it associates with, who its members are. And to have turned that over to the courts in a settlement or to the United States, to the Interior Department, is really unthinkable. And of course, at the time, Santa Clara versus Pueblo versus Martinez had already been decided. There was no subject matter jurisdiction over the courts to determine tribal membership, and parties can't confer that subject matter jurisdiction on the courts, so the settlement couldn't have allowed the courts to address tribal membership, because they didn't have the subject matter jurisdiction to do so. They don't now, and they didn't then. So those are essentially my points. If there are any questions.
We also have, do we not, the temporal problem in that the settlement itself had a one-year trigger?
Yes, it could be enforced. If we got to the point of any past subject matter jurisdiction, the settlement itself was limited to 1 year. And that made sense. It did not envision the ongoing enforcement over the tribes. The tribe hadn't even developed a constitution within 1 year. The membership criteria were still being developed in 85.
I assume there was no casino at that time.
They would have to have been a federally recognized tribe to get a casino. I don't actually remember when the statute was passed or when they got their casino in it. No, any of that. But.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll give you a minute rebuttal, Ms. Philly.
Your Honor, regarding the one-year rule, as stated in our complaint, we never received notice of the class certification. We never received notice of the proposed settlement or giving us the right to object. They just ignored us because there was a collective little band of these little named plaintiffs and their friends, their favorite relatives, to decide who was going to be members, and they wanted to keep everything themselves. 1 year, we didn't know about it. And how would we know whether or not our status as Indians were restored? How would we know that? They claim that, council claims that it was brought by the tribe and by inhabitant individuals as Indians. We're talking about a 15-acre parcel, yet when they got the class certification, they said that the people that they are protecting are the ones that are scattered all over, and they're so numerous, we don't know who they are. What do they got now? They got 74 members. So much for numerosity, but that's what they claimed. There was no reason for it to be a class certification of distributees and dependents if it was isolated to only those that lived on the reservation, because they also included offspring, and they also said they were so numerous. I mean, it wasn't a concentration camp there. People spread out all over the place because there were no jobs and there were no schools. What we want is the same thing that they got in Table Mountain versus Watt.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case just argued is submitted, and we will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.